Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast on Rethinking Sex Education. The project is based on some pretty good evidence that what we Christians are doing to educate our young people about their sexuality is not working. So each week on this podcast, I'm posting some thoughts to help us get a conversation started and together to hammer out something viable and helpful that we can give our young people. So I hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment either on the blog page or on the Facebook page, and I really hope you'll feel free to disagree. Those are actually the comments that are usually the most interesting and the most fun. And at the end of the project, I'll turn what we learned together into a book, and I'd love to have your input into the process. So let's begin this week's episode titled Evolution, Brain Chemistry, and the Stages of Love. In this episode, I want to expand a theme we began in the last. Last week, we saw how the ancient Greeks, who framed so much of our Western worldview and whose rich mythology deeply explored and named the strengths and the foibles of the human condition, we saw how they framed the human experience of love in a more textured and more layered, a more developmentally progressive way than we tend to. Their words for and their conceptualization of love help us outline a developmental process through which the full experience of love unfolds over a lifetime. One way of loving leads us into the next, which in turn leads us into the next, and each in turn draws us more deeply into the human experience, more deeply into human fulfillment, each expanding our experience of what matters most in our lives. So a quick recap from last time. There are several Greek words for love. We looked at five of them: mania, eros, philos, pragma, and agape. Mania is the crazy stage that we call falling in love. Eros is sexual erotic attraction and romance. Philos is friendship love. Pragma is attachment love, a life built together kind of love. And agape is the love of the elder, the love that is given without reference to the merit of the beloved. It is the love that just is. Now, in our own culture, we don't tend to think of the first two of these words as love at all. We tend to think of chemical sexual attraction as lust or instinct, or we think of it as an impulse or a drive or animal attraction. We tend not to count the experience of a 16-year-old boy dripping with hormones as love. But the Greeks, again, with their knack for understanding and naming the human condition, they put chemical love on the love spectrum. Long before brain science, they understood how important chemicals are for moving us into the deeper human experience of love. They had a holistic view of the brain-body-chemical oneness. They intuitively understood that chemical attraction is a very important stage in the evolutionary process of making love. For reasons we'll look at in a minute, the chemical stages are important in and of themselves, but they are also important in their role as booster rockets. They help carry us from one stage of love into the next. In our own culture, where we separate out chemical attraction from the developmental process of making love, we tend to diminish it. We miss that it is the first in a series of steps that move us into the deeper love experience. And divorced from this larger stage developmental process, we tend to miss chemical love's true importance. But as we're framing the context for helping us hammer out a sexual curriculum for our young people, we have to understand how the chemical love stage of the journey works. It is a gateway. It's a gateway into an ever-deepening level of human experience. Now, we struggle with certain limits and liabilities around our sexuality in our culture because, unlike the Greeks, we uncouple chemical love from the love spectrum. And one of those liabilities is that we experience chemical attraction divorced from its place in the developmental journey, and as we do, we diminish it. So let's look at chemical love for just a moment. Julian Fellowes is probably best known these days as the creator of the television series Downton Abbey. He's also an actor and a director and a novelist, and I found this was interesting. He's also been a member of Parliament in the UK. In a novel he wrote called Snobs, he described mania or eros love, chemical love, this way. It is that state commonly known as being love, or being in love, is a kind of madness. It is a distortion of reality so remarkable that it should enable most of us to understand other forms of lunacy and sympathize with our fellow sufferers. In other words, if you've ever been in love, he's saying, you should be able to sympathize with anybody who has any kind of mental disorder. And then he continues, and he says, and yet, as we all know, it is a madness that, however ferocious, seldom, if ever, lasts. And as mad and suffering as one is in the heat of the flame, few of us are glad as we feel that passion slip away. While many have been at their unhappiest when in love, it is nevertheless the state the human being yearns for above all. Chemical love makes us crazy, but it is powerful. It is intoxicating. It is a primeval human experience, the existence of which assures the continuation of our species. And because it is so powerful, we've seen in previous weeks, our marketers and our advertisers are doing their dead level best to tap into it. They have finally honed a sexual curriculum for our young people that focuses almost exclusively on this iteration of love. Of course they do. It's exhilarating and it's enthralling. As Fellows said, it is the state we humans yearn for above all. But again, uncoupled from the developmental process of these stages of love, by itself, chemical love has limits. Some pretty important limits. Another reason that marketers try to evoke chemical love is because it makes us stupid. If you were reading my notes, you'd see a footnote taking you to a web article on medicaldaily.com. You should Google it. But by evoking mania and by evoking eros, this could potentially, advertisers believe, make us stupid enough to believe the images that stream across our televisions, that a trip on a cruise ship or a bag of barbecue briquettes or a bottle of beer will somehow fulfill our deep longing for mania for erotic love. Now, under the influence of a chemical wash, the frontal cortex part of our brains shuts down. The brain that we use to exercise good judgment, the part that doubts, the part that is skeptical, that part of us shuts down under the influence of these earlier stages of love, chemical love. Brain scientists doing MRI scans can see the part of our brain that exercises good judgment go quiet. Blood actually stops flowing to that part of the brain as we are shown a picture of a person toward whom we feel these chemical stages, this mania erotic feeling of love. Now, that has to be an ideal state for a potential customer if you want to try and sell them something they don't really need. You want them stupid. In our heart of hearts, we know that the new shoes won't fulfill the deep pull of our multi-layered sexuality, but it doesn't really matter what we know, because the part of our brain that applies what we know, that part shuts down. Mania, and parts of the eros love, the chemical love, is less an emotion than it is a drive. It is more like hunger than it is like happiness. It happens in the deep interior part of the brain. It releases a rush of chemicals to the core, reptilian part of us. This is the instinct brain, the brain that keeps us breathing or drives us to find food. So, falling in love is in fact deeper than emotion. It is deeper than cognitive reasoning. This innate part of us produces an intense focus, an intense energy. It generates voracious craving, extreme waves of motivation. We work doggedly to get the one we want to mate with us. It's the unstoppable energy of obsession, and it can consume us. It can make us willing to risk everything in order to win the prize. And it acts like an addiction. We focus on one person, we obsess over that person, and we normalize the three main characteristics of addiction. We build up a tolerance. That's what addiction does. We need more and more and more of that person. We suffer withdrawal. It hurts when we don't have that person. We relapse. We fall back into the craving again and again. Chemical love is an addictive substance. Now again, this whole process makes a lot of sense from an evolutionary perspective. It is one of the best parts of being human. We love being in love. And it is good that we do, because the survival of humanity has depended on us falling into this obsessive kind of frenzy. We move heaven and earth. We overpower whatever gets in our way to get the one that we want to mate with us. And under the influence of this chemical wash, under the influence of being in love, we've been willing to upend our whole lives. We'll leave our homes and our communities and our families. We're willing to give up jobs and careers and savings and land, riches, even titles. We do all this under the influence of the chemicals in mania eros. Our brains ignore the big picture to zero in on breeding. And in the past, the brains that did evolve this way were more likely to pass their genetic material on to the next generation, who, in turn, carry the higher brain shutdown trait into their breeding practice, which again has worked out swimmingly for the human race. You and I are here carrying this trait because many generations before us, our ancestors selected for this trait. But as we are thinking about creating a sexual training curriculum for our young people, we have to consider for a moment the downside of this evolutionary mechanism. We have to consider the downside of shutting off the part of the brain that makes good decisions. When we uncouple chemical love from a lifetime of love, developmental love, when we separate out animal attraction from its place in a larger system, we accentuate the downside of making a breeding decision at the expense of making a considered decision. Yes, we keep the species going, but we do all kinds of crazy stuff. When this evolutionary trait goes unchecked, we definitely don't lead with our best thinking. Consider the illogical risks that people take to have an affair. They risk destroying what they love the most, their children, their family, their finances and careers, and they do this to feed this mania eros love drive. Unchecked, that's what our brains do. So again, chemical love has become the dominating feature of the sex education strategy of the advertising industrial complex. But again, our approach has exposed us to these considerable limits, these liabilities. For one, for another, chemical love has a pretty short shelf life. Mania lasts a year, maybe two, before the intense state stops. Eroticism waxes and wanes. It comes and it goes over the course of a lifetime. Mania has to calm down. It really does. It is just too brain energy intensive to be able to sustain it for long. When my wife and I were in mania love, I was a poor student, and I used up all my money, and I ran my car into the ground, driving an hour back and forth to her house on the other side of Los Angeles. And I never wanted to come home once I was there. I never wanted to leave her. I would stay with her until 3 o'clock in the morning, even though I had to get up in the morning at 8 a.m. the next day. And I'd drag myself home in the wee hours, more than once falling asleep as I was driving. It was crazy. It was unsustainable. I loved it, but it was unsustainable. I mean, it's a good thing that we went out to eat together, or I would never have eaten during those years. That's what chemical love does. It uses up all the energy that we have. We don't eat, we don't sleep, we don't work, we hardly take care of life. We make drastic changes to our habits and our schedules and our lives. We turn our days inside out in order to win, in order to be with the object of our affection. Getting our genetic material passed along is that important. But it is also true that if the insanity didn't die down after a while, the species wouldn't be able to survive over the long haul. That's why chemical love has such a short shelf life. Imagine that once we have mated, once the breeding has happened, and now there is a newborn baby, the evolutionary end game, and there sits baby at the dinner table, hungry. But mom and dad are in the throes of chemical love still. They don't even see the child because they're only focused on chasing each other around the house, getting each other into bed, getting into each other's pants. Staying in chemical love has also been selected out of our species over time. Love has to change. We have to evolve from our overriding passion for the erotic side of our sexuality into the loving parent side of our sexuality. And then we have to evolve from the loving parent side to being loving companions, really to just simply being loving people for whom love just is. This is the developmental process. Mania love has to evolve to become eros love, has to evolve to become pragma and philos love, has to evolve to become agape love. As we saw in the last episode, our sexuality makes us carers, makes us creators. Our sexuality inevitably leads us to becoming elders, those upon whose shoulders the family and the society rest. Our sexuality grows us. It makes us creative. It makes us caring. The earlier stages of love get things going. The later stages keep things going. And it is a process that fosters healthy lives and healthy families, really a healthy society. And the thing is, our brains have evolved to take us down this long path. There is a pathway embedded in the human condition that will carry us along this full developmental journey. And if we follow this ancient and this natural path, it positions us within the wisdom of thousands of years of human experience, really within thousands of years of religious experience. However, the current sex curriculum, the curriculum on which our young people are being weaned, it is a curriculum that has detached mania, eros, love from the larger process and has focused almost exclusively on chemical love. It is a divorced from the big picture version of sex education. It's focused on the explosive fire of physical arousal at the expense of the extended release versions of love. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong. Pray to God that eroticism never goes away in your life, as I pray in mine. Never leaves our bodies. Physical passion comes along with us as we go through the stages of love. We don't leave it behind. But on its own, uncoupled from the developmental process, chemical love just doesn't have that much staying power. It doesn't have what is required to sustain the full journey to love. Detaching mania eros out, as we have tended to do, minimizes our chances of fully embracing the attachment benefits that come with pragma love. It minimizes the growth of selflessness that happens when we engage philos love, and it minimizes the transformative power of agape love. Our current normalization of the everybody-screws-everybody hookup culture makes mania, eros, an end in itself, which makes no sense when we see eroticism as an important and powerful drive, but not as the whole journey. When we don't teach our young people the desirability over a lifetime of love's progressive dynamic, their lives get constrained, get limited by the shortcomings of chemical love. By default, we train our young people for the hookup culture, where they use their chemical love, which, by the way, is a finite resource, but they use it as an end in itself instead of an important stage on a journey moving them into fulfilling lives of love. Chemical love serves an important function on this journey. Chemical love has a powerful bonding function. Orgasms release two important chemicals, vasopressin and oxytocin. They, along with adrenaline and along with dopamine, these are strong chemical players in mania, eros, love. They don't just create the fireworks and the passion of eroticism. They also help us move forward on the journey by helping us form attachments. It turns out that simple sexual experiences like cuddling or fondling release these bonding chemicals, which is doubly true during intercourse and during orgasm. Chemicals help us form the attachments that keep us together long enough to raise offspring, long enough to experience all the phases of love. Oxytocin is released by both men and women during orgasm. It deepens attachment, and it creates feelings of closeness after sex. In women, it's also released during labor and creates strong bonding attachments between mother and child. Now, we can override the bonding effect of these sexual chemicals on our bodies, but the effect is there. Vasopressin is also released during orgasm, and in the male, in particular, it creates a desire to stay with his mate. It elicits the protective instinct toward the woman, toward offspring. It creates an interest in maintaining the well-being of the new forming family. Now again, we can override the bonding effects of sexual chemicals on our bodies, but the effect is there. Now, everyone knows men are more wired to spread their seed broadly, but the release of vasopressin during sex helps balance out this innate instinct. A man's body communicates to him after sex. It tells him that the woman he has just been with is now in a different category than all the other women out there. An orgasm with her changes her from a potential partner to a potential mother for his children. Jennifer Morse wrote about vasopressin in her book. It's called Smart Sex. It produces, she says, it produces a caring, defending, and protective instinct toward the woman. It evokes a strong instinct of loyalty toward her and toward their offspring. And she cites statistics showing the vast majority of men who go to great lengths to provide child support for their children, even when they are not permitted to see their children. It turns out that the stereotype, all men are rutting pigs, is only part of the story. Men are wired for a far deeper experience of love than can be experienced by merely getting laid. Chemical love draws us toward erotic pleasure in a really big way, and aren't we all glad that it does? However, that's only part of the story. Chemicals also move us forward on the ancient pathway to the deeper ways to make love. Our culture minimizes the bonding impact of sexual encounter, but our bodies know the ancient truth. Chemical love takes us somewhere. But the sexual norms that we've been trying out in this social experiment over the last 50 years, these norms are reducing our chances for healthy attachments in our lives. These norms are reducing our chances for deeper love, both the pragma and the agape kind. One-night stands and casual sex release bonding chemicals, but our response to those chemicals gets deadened if we don't move forward with the bonding they create. Friends with benefits and informal flings, they do the same. They work against the attaching process that is wired into us. It turns out that the very term casual sex is an internal contradiction. Sex, by the release of these bonding chemicals, creates attachments. It creates non-casual dynamics in relationships. Our brains make sure that sex doesn't remain casual. Now again, we can deaden ourselves to the bonding force in our brains. We can dull this powerful chemical influence in our relationships. We do it all the time. But when we do, we thwart the ancient path, the ancient wisdom. So the wisdom of the brain is this. Don't have sex with somebody you don't want to attach to. Have sex, and we do develop feelings for one another. That's just the way it works. Ancient wisdom understood that, and understood it in the context of a lifetime of stage developmental love. People get attached through chemicals, attached deeply enough to learn and to experience the forms of love that are deeper than chemical love. Now, we all know people who have attached to people that are no good for their lives. Sure we do. It happens all the time. Casual, unconsidered sexual relationships often create unwise, unhealthy, ill-considered relationships. And young people need to know this. And they need to know it before they jump headlong into our hookup culture. And they need to know it before they jump blindly into one another's pants. Now, in the past, the main lesson in religious sexual education was this: don't have sex until you get married. As we'll see in the next episode, that lesson came with a heavy dose of prudishness, and it came with a pretty unhealthy, it's the rules vibe. Guilt and dirtiness were usually in the mix. Yes, there was baggage. But for all the toxins that got attached to the wait until you get married lesson, it was a helpful lesson in this way. It provided banks for the rushing river of our sexual energy. It gave us boundaries to help us work with our brains and to work with our bodies and to work with our chemicals. Our current world, on the other hand, runs without rules. So nobody knows where the boundaries lie. Nobody knows what sexual practices lead to good outcomes. Now, the purpose of this project is to help us rethink sexual education from a religious perspective, and when we do, we have to factor in the importance of brain chemistry. We'll need to see chemical love as it fits into a lifetime of love making. Now, in the next episode, we're going to look at how religion lost its way, how religion lost its voice and has lost its moral authority to even talk about sex. We'll see how we became carriers of the sex is dirty toxin. We need to see where we lost our way so that we can begin to see how to find our way again. So we'll pick up here in the next episode. And as always, I'd love to hear what you're thinking. Post your comments at DougHammock.com or go to the Facebook link that led you to the podcast, or even private message me on Facebook. All right, we'll pick up here next time.